Are you ready now?
Yes, sir.
Daniel chapter 11. Page 974, if you have a Bible like mine. Now, for several Sundays, we've been pointing out, you must understand the gap theory to understand prophecy. This is the gap. Let's lay it on good. Gap. G-A-P. I don't need any help. I know how to pull a shade down. Some of you thought I'd forgotten. I just like the drama. I've exploited that three Sundays. I want to see how many more I can get away with. Now, for years, there were those that called the book of Daniel a pseudo-epigram. That's fancy. Someone who wrote a book after the fact and put a famous, holy, biblical personality's name to it. Hence, pseudo-epigram. And by putting someone else's name to it, and I'm a hair too loud, John, not much, but a little too loud, they would add prestige to their writing. Well, they were also liars. I continue to get amazed at so-called higher criticism. You can give me just a hair more now, John. So-called higher criticism that proceeds to demolish the authorship because it would require a miracle if the true author were, in fact, who he says he is. So they proceed to destroy the authorship so they don't have to believe in miracle. And then, after having turned the author into a liar, sailing under false pretenses, and claiming to write in a century long before he lived, they then write whole books trying to interpret and give value to what he says. One of my messages in this series will borrow from the phrase of a book handed out many years by Campus Crusade for Christ called Daniel in the Critic's Den. Suffice it to say, I will get to that. And when you see the title something like that, because I don't want to invade somebody's copyright, but something like Daniel in the Critic's Den or Daniel Faces His Critics, no, that's the Sunday. We're going to deal with those who try to make Daniel history instead of prophecy. It's a very and fairly easy task to demolish those whose sole reason for making Daniel a fake, they don't want to accept God's control over history and the miraculous fact of prophecy fulfilled. It's a fairly easy task to show that Daniel was the true author of the book. Just let me tell you, I'm going to deal with that. Because once Daniel's authorship is established. We have one of the most amazing proofs of God's control over history anywhere illustrated. Now, we've traced the prophecies of Daniel in the imagery of Nebuchadnezzar's image. The head of gold, the sides or shoulders of silver, sides of brass, legs of iron, feet with 10 toes, iron and clay. We've traced those kingdoms down to the 10-toed kingdom and demonstrated that there is a gap between the leg kingdom of iron, which is the Roman Empire, and a restoration of that empire in some form symbolized by iron and clay mixed together in the last days. And we know that that 10-toed kingdom occurs in the last days because a stone kingdom destroys it and sets up the kingdom eternal. So the 10-toed kingdom is the last kingdom on the face of this earth before Christ sets up the eternal kingdom called the stone kingdom. We've looked at Daniel's vision of the beasts. Again, we've seen it is a series of kingdoms that flow out of Babylon. The Lion Kingdom, the Bear Kingdom, the Medo-Persian, the Leopard Kingdom, the Grecian, the nondescript beast that has no analogy among earthly animals, so it's just called a nondescript beast. And it has 10 horns. And we've seen that once again the gap occurs between the nondescript beast, as from the Iron Kingdom to the 10-toed, between the nondescript beast and the 10-horned kingdom is the gap. And we add detail in that vision that this 10-horned kingdom, once again, is the last kingdom on this earth. But as you move the telescope of prophecy closer, you find that a little horn grows up among these 10, uproots 3, then is given a kingdom, and in the days of the little horn kingdom comes Christ to set up his kingdom. We then move the telescope of prophecy in the third vision to the two beasts, the ram and the goat. This focused in on only 2 of the previous kingdoms, the ram being the Medo-Persian, the goat being Alexander the Great or the Grecian kingdom, with the notable horn being Alexander the Great. That's not Assembly of God, that's Alexander the Great. Because this AG is going to be demon-possessed. So I want to make sure that there's no misunderstandings here. The notable horn is Alexander the Great, and that horn broken off produces the 4-horned kingdom, which are the 4 generals that divide up Alexander the Great's massive empire. We then know the gap occurs. And once again, we see a little horn that is the evil Antichrist. And we know that the little horn in this third vision adds detail as the first glimpse in Nebuchadnezzar's image just lets us know that in the last days, a restored kingdom will occur of 10 units that occupy the territory or fall inside the territory once ruled by the Iron Kingdom, Rome. The next vision lets us know that not only will there be what some call a restored Roman Empire, but a little horn in an area conflict will uproot 3 and be given rulership over the rest. In the ram and the goat vision, we're able to locate the little horn as coming out of the territory covered by Alexander the Great's great empire. Then we come to Daniel 11. And Daniel 11 will sharpen the focus like a microscopic search. And whereas we saw with broad sweep the kingdoms out of Babylon, producing a last kingdom of 10 units, the beast out of Babylon producing a 10-unit kingdom inside of which a little horn, not a world war, but a little conflict, will uproot 3. And the third vision of the ram and the goat locates the little horn in that portion of the 10-toed kingdom that comes out of the broad Roman Empire territory, precisely focuses it more eastward than Europe and puts it in the territory of Alexander the Great's empire. Daniel 11 will move it sharply eastward to just 2 units of Alexander the Great's empire, namely the king of the north and the king of the south. And the king of the north is the Seleucid kingdom that stretches from Babylon to Antioch on the coast, Palestine in its northern portions, Lebanon, Syria, southern Turkey, Iran, Iraq today. That's the north, the king of the north. The king of the south, which is the subject of Daniel 11, the Ptolemies, Egypt. And in great detail, boring detail, as I said last Sunday, doing a history major, undergraduate history major, reading, that is, being his assistant, correcting all papers for the history prof while I was doing my master's, not once did we study this history that Daniel 11 focuses like a microscope on. It's boring history, viewed from the broad stream of world history. At first glance, it appears unimportant. All we learned about the Seleucid generals, and we learned about the Ptolemies, we learned about Cleopatra, because the movie gave her so much attention, the history professor had to act like he knew something. We learned about Antiochus Epiphanes, because he was the ruler of the Seleucid branch that came down, and by declaring himself God and offering neutral treatment to all religions in his kingdom, if they would recognize his authority, Epiphanes, meaning God manifest, Antiochus Epiphanes, appropriating that quality to himself, found old Judas Maccabeus, the religious leader in a little Jewish town, told him because he was the leader, he ought to take the lead in respecting this decree of Antiochus. And Judas Maccabeus said, not only will I not respect it, I'll kill every man, woman, and child in my village that does. And the Maccabean Rebellion was born that gave freedom to the Jews again, set the stage for the Jewish kingdom that was there when Christ came, and became the basis for Hanukkah, which the Jews celebrate at Christmas time, and they now tend to emphasize the lighting of the lights without emphasizing it was a rebellion against tyranny and a celebration of freedom. The lighting of the lights was because, having won the rebellion, the sons of Judas Maccabeus and their followers who won the revolution lit the candlestick again and cleansed the temple. And that's the basis of Hanukkah. That's about as far as my history knowledge from secular sources would go on this period. And yet God's holy word concentrates a whole chapter. One chapter that traces from Babylon to the end of time, that makes sense. Beasts from Babylon to the end of time, and the beast Antichrist, that makes sense. Even the ram and the goat, because it locates the territory of Antichrist, that makes sense. Why? A boring chapter on Syria and Egypt, or Iran, Syria, and Iraq, and that section of the Grecian Empire broken down, fighting against Egypt. Why a whole chapter on that? So, we can know where on this earth Antichrist will come from. And so we can keep our wits about us. And when people begin to suggest there's going to be an atomic holocaust and we're all going to be blown up, you can say, no, we're not. And I can't, you know, I never tire of saying this. This is one of my favorite repetitive items. And when Pat Robinson said, during the Lebanon crisis, how many years ago was it, that Russia would come down and fulfill the Russia chapters, Ezekiel 38 and 39. You remember I said, no, they won't. There are other things that must happen first. And the Lebanon crisis will not bring Russia down. I never tire of this. Indulge me, please. He was wrong. I was right. And he's running for president. Which proves takes more to be a prophecy preacher than to be a president. Now, indeed. Too bad the president wasn't a prophet. He could have headed off some of the current mess. Now, let me bore you with Daniel 11 with this backdrop. It serves a purpose. By its boring detail, so accurately fulfilled, that it became the basis for saying Daniel was history written by a liar after the fact rather than prophecy. I told you I'll handle that later. As prophecy, this is the most detailed demonstration of God's power over history that I know of anywhere. Now I'll give one more illustration and then we'll be into it. As I was working with my faith in college, I remember a story out of Alexander the Great's history. There's a prophecy, a series of them in the Old Testament, about the two cities, Tyre and Sidon, both in Lebanon. The prophecy said they would be destroyed many times. Well, you can say that about just about any city. But there was a difference between what was said about Tyre and what was said about Sidon. Sidon would be destroyed. But the prophet put detail in about Tyre. He said it would not only be destroyed, the city would be scraped bare to the bedrock, and the rubble of the city be cast into the sea. And that's pretty detailed. I remember my reactions when I was studying Greek history. Alexander the Great, sweeping like a scythe down the coast of Palestine, confronts Tyre in its new condition. Prior to Alexander, Tyre had gotten tired of constantly being exposed to attack and constantly being reduced to rubble. So they made a decision to move from the old site of the city, which they abandoned, and build a new city on an island just off the coast. Alexander the Great comes down, seeking to attack the new city on the island off the coast. He scraped the rubble of the old city and threw it into the sea to build a causeway. And having built the causeway from the rubble of the old city, he crossed on the causeway to attack the new city, Tyre. And he scraped it so bare, another element of the prophecy was fulfilled, which stated that fishermen would dry their nets on the bare rocks of the city, which they began to do. Now, detail like that is pretty hard to ignore. Those were the prophetic kinds that began to get my attention of faith. And I preach for one reason, to produce faith. Faith cometh by hearing, hearing by the Word of God. God's performance displayed in this book becomes the basis for believing that God, whose word is forever settled in heaven, will keep the promises that He's made to us, His church. Now let's dive in. First year, chapter 11, of Darius the Mede. Are you prepared for detailing boredom now? It's the boredom of the detail that shows God off. The speaker is, in Jewish tradition, Gabriel. Whatever the tradition, it is the angel that the 10th chapter displays bringing the answer of prayer to Daniel. I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood to confirm and strengthen him. Now, the majority of the Jewish Masoretic texts refer to him in this verse that Gabriel stood to strengthen as Michael, the archangel. And we have the continuation of that strange conflict referred to in the 10th chapter, between angelic beings, fallen ones, the prince of Persia, and the prince of Grecia who will come, and Gabriel and Michael, who fought their way through the territory of the prince of the power of the air to bring Daniel his message. But with that final reference to that angelic conflict, the angel now begins to prophesy. Now, he says, will I show thee the truth. There shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. Write them down. Cyrus, Cambyses, Cambyses, Darius, Hystaspes, Hys, Taspis, and the fourth, Xerxes. He is the fourth. He's the third of the three yet to stand up.
The original of this,
in essence, says four kings, three yet to stand up, the fourth of the four, of which there are three yet to come, shall be far richer than they all. You can trace in history Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius Astaspes, and Xerxes. Now, I'd just soon never hear their names again. The only point I want to make is history confirms three more, the fourth being, counting the present one, Xerxes. And he indeed becomes the richest of them all. Then it says, by his strength through his riches, Xerxes, by his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Now these are Medo-Persian kings, ram kings, bear kings, silver kings, to go back to the other images. Xerxes, the richest of those yet to come after the time of this prophecy by the angel, will be so rich that power will go to his head, and he will stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Verse 3, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion. Notice the emphasis on great dominion or great power. And do according to his will. That great king is Alexander the Great, not the Assemblies of God. I want to keep that straight. A mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. It is a matter of fact that Alexander the Great once wrote a treatise explaining and defending why he attacked Medo-Persia to justify his excursion into Babylon. He refers to the attack by Xerxes against Persia. Now, unless this is seen as prophecy, it's just a boring recital. But now, instead of talking in images of gold, silver, and brass, and iron, and lions, and bears, and leopards, and nondescript beasts, and rams, and goats, now this angel's standing there writing history in advance. Okay, there's going to be three more kings, totaling four, counting now, and we're going to have the fourth one richer than the others. He and his riches is going to stir up a great king, and that great king's going to come and everything fall before him. He's now written the history clear up to Alexander the Great. When he shall stand up, Alexander the Great, his kingdom shall be broken. We know the history. In his prime, outside of Babylon, Alexander the Great dies. And his kingdom shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, not to his posterity. Now we know that there was a struggle by a certain group within Alexander's palace to put his posterity on the throne. Instead, it broke up, not according to his posterity, but it broke up to his generals. And then an interesting phrase, not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion. We've referenced that dominion already as the beast from the pit. And I won't go through that today, except to state what this verse says. Whatever else these four generals have, They don't have Alexander the Great's power. Now, Ptolemy Legid got Egypt. You understand all this, don't you? Huh? It's all very clear, isn't it? Now, let's draw a little map. There's Turkey. Here in Mesopotamian area, and rivers Euphrates and the Tigris. Now we have Lebanon, and Syria, and Iraq, and Iran, and Transjordan, and Palestine, and Egypt. Now the Ptolemies got to Egypt area. Seleucus is going to get what we call the Syrian area. Another one of the generals gets the Macedonian area, and a fourth one gets the Grecian peninsula. So the great Alexander, the great empire, breaks into these four sections among his generals: Ptolemy Legid, Seleucus Nicator, Lysimachus, and Cassander. Now, it's about as important you remember those names as that other bunch of names. It's unimportant except for the gestalt of this moment. The imminent detail written in advance by the prophesying angel. This is why higher critics say it has to be history. Therefore, Daniel couldn't have written it. Somebody had to write it after the fact, put his name on it, and stick it on to the end of Daniel. I'll deal with that. They're full of spit. But in the meantime, let me show you why they want to call it history. You can't write history in advance like this if you don't believe in God or miracles. His kingdom shall be divided toward the four winds and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those of his posterity. Seleucus Nicator, one of the generals, was driven from Babylon and out of the main eastern thrust of the kingdom by Antigonus. Antigonus sought to place on the throne Alexander the Great, dying near Babylon, successors of natural posterity to Alexander the Great. He drove the general Seleucus Nicator out, who took refuge with Ptolemy down here in Egypt. Ptolemy gave him a bunch of soldiers. He went back and kicked the hell out of Antigonus. You got all that? I mean, I can give you all the blood and the name counts and the other things that remain, but it's really reduced down to Antigonus sought to work through a puppet government of those that were the successors of Alexander the Great. Prophecy said his posterity wouldn't rule, but four, not his posterity and not in his power, would rule. Sure enough, in fulfillment of prophecy, Seleucus Nicator, I repeat, taking temporary asylum with Ptolemy Legid, gets a division of soldiers and comes back and kicks the hell out of Antigonus. Now, the one attempt by Satan, I believe, to force prophecy not to be carried out in order that the faithfulness of God might be eroded, sought to seize the heartland of Alexander the Great's empire in defiance of what prophecy said. He lost. And sure enough, four generals end up owning and dividing the territory. Once Seleucid is established in Babylon with an alternate site at Antioch on the coast, these two, Ptolemy, who gave him the division that got him restored in Babylon, these two began an unending conflict. And from this point on in Daniel 11, the king of the north will refer to Seleucid and his successors. The king of the south will refer to Ptolemy in Egypt and his successors. I repeat, the king of the north to the Seleucid portion. These two sections of Alexander's empire tend to disappear from this biblical prophecy as not very important. And the two that remain and are cataloged throughout the rest of the chapter are the king of the north, the Babylonian-Syrian portion, the king of the south, the Egyptian portion. Got that? Because those who hunt and peck in Scripture, I'm going to say what I said last Sunday, love to take a phrase like the king of the north. Then they go to Ezekiel 38, where that great kingdom of the north that is located in the area where Russia now rules comes down to cover like a storm Palestine. And they immediately make an erroneous connect-up because Russia's north, they make Daniel 11, king of the north, mean Russia. That isn't the case. I suppose, I said last Sunday, if some Eskimos would get an atomic bomb, we'd have a new big book written about the king of the north. Daniel 11 identifies the king of the north with precision. Babylon, Antioch, Babylon, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, southern Turkey. That's the king of the north, somewhere in there. King of the south, Egypt. That's why I told you, through all the time, that Sadat was being mentioned as the man of peace, symbolized by the man on the white horse with a bow and no arrow. I said, no, he can't be. The role of Egypt in the last days is to be a disturber of the peace, not a peacemaker. Someone will rise up in Egypt that'll make Libya and their Gaddafi look like preparation. The troublemaker of the last days will be Egypt. And just prior to Armageddon, Antichrist, ruling from this area of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, southern Turkey, will be going down in another battle against Egypt when he hears tidings out of the north and out of the east that cause him to turn back from Egypt, and he will return to the area of his kingdom, and he'll be in the plain of Megiddo, which is the immediate prelude to the Battle of Armageddon. Now, all of this is yet to happen before any Armageddon comes. And in Armageddon, there are no nuclear weapons. Blood will flow in one battle. Blood doesn't flow when the Big Bang comes. They will spend 7 months and then 7 years in the first portion of the millennium digging graves and burning the implements of war. Nuclear holocaust doesn't leave much of that work to be done. Hurry up, we got a camera falling. You guys move pretty fast. Well, that's a first. If that had fallen with a big bang, right when I'm talking about this, I can just visualize it. All you men and women of faith that know God's in control, right at that moment, if that had fallen, all I would have seen would have been backslides. But I'm working on you. You okay up there? How do we get back to Armageddon? You folks watching on television, I don't know what started it, but that camera was toppling up there. All right, everybody take a deep breath. Now let it out. He will be fighting Egypt when news takes him back to Megiddo, and there won't be a nuclear holocaust. After millennium, Satan will be released from that bottomless pit to jump way ahead in Revelation. He'll make a beeline to the territory of Russia. He will still find after the millennium those that will join him and come down and besiege the holy city, and a second time of destruction occurs after the millennium, and that is fire falling from heaven. If there's a nuclear holocaust, that's when it'll happen, after the millennium, not before. But that's all thrown in free. The king of the north and the king of the south is now defined. You got it? Let's see what they do. The king of the south shall be strong. That's Ptolemy. One of his princes, that's Seleucid, who was driven by Antigonus down to Egypt, and shall be strong above him and have dominion and shall be a great dominion. Seleucus, given troops, goes and defeats Antigonus, cements his territory, and actually becomes stronger than Ptolemy. They begin to threaten one another, but the sixth verse says, in the end of the years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south, Egypt, shall come to the king of the north, Babylon, Syria, to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Now, what in the hell does that mean? You could write a movie about what happened here. Let me tell you. I'll read from a very famous Anglican commentary, the pulpit commentary, probably the most respected of all general commentaries ever written. This is what they say concerning this sixth verse. The reference here is generally understood to be to the affinity made by the Lagids, that's the Ptolemy Lagids of Egypt, and the Seleucids, Babylon, Syria, when Berenice, there she is again, when Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus, married Antiochus II, old Ted, Theos, who repudiated his first wife, Laodice, in order to do so. So in order to marry the daughter, Berenice, of a successor to the Ptolemy Lagids, namely Ptolemy Philadelphus, a successor to Seleucid rulers, Antiochus II, or Teos, Theodore, Ted, he repudiates his wife Laodice and marries Berenice, the daughter of the Ptolemy of Egypt. Again, I don't want to lose you in the detail. The point is, this is all a boring focus on Syria, Babylon versus Egypt, and all their little intrigues, their little manipulations,
their little diplomatic struggles and their fights that will bring us over the gap to a last day struggle between the same areas, and in this area of the King of the North will rise up Antichrist, who is the little horn, who rules the final kingdom, who is the person into whom the beast from the pit goes, and he rules in full orb power during the tribulation and makes a 7-year covenant or contract with the Jews. That's the importance of this detail. So old Antiochus II, Teddy, married Berenice and said to Laodike, "Get lost." Laodike didn't like the idea. After the death of Berenice's father, Philadelphus, old Ted no longer needed to be so nice to Berenice, because the marriage to Berenice and the removal of Laodike was to get an alliance with Ptolemy Philadelphus, so they'd quit fighting for a while and have a good time. But when old Ptolemy Philadelphus died, he takes a look at Berenice and says, "You're ugly. You're no good to me anymore. Oh, Philadelphus, your dad is dead. What can you do for me? So I'm going back to Laodike." "You're awful." "Her full name is Laodike." "You got that? I'm going back to Laodike. She's prettier than you." So Antiochus Theodore took back Laodike, who, as soon as she got back, decided the weather wouldn't change anymore. She poisoned Berenice. Berenice and Antiochus Theos' son, and old Teddy himself. She laid them all low. That's all in verse 6. You got that? That's quite a lot of detail to write in advance. Now, all of that was said like this. "In the end of the years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south, Berenice, shall come to the king of the north, O Teddy, to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of his arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times, all of them dead. The only one left, Laodike. But," verse 7, ain't history fascinating? "But out of a branch of her roots." That's a way of describing in-laws I haven't heard yet. Can't you see us on Thanksgiving Day carving the turkey and say, "Here, branch of my roots. Gnaw on this a while." "Out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail." You want me to translate that? "Euergetes, brother of Berenice, angry at what Laodike had done to poison his sister, captured Seleucia and Antioch and the king of the Seleucid kingdom, retreated behind the Taurus mountains, while the king of the south, through Euergetes, the brother of Berenice, gained the ascendancy over the north." The king of the south was now on top. Now, do you want to know what he's going to do now that he's on top? I'll see you next Sunday.